Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Thursday, the Supreme Court sided with the Obama administration by upholding a key provision of the Affordable Care Act. In a 6-3 ruling, the court upheld subsidies for more than 6 million people living in 34 states. President Obama welcomed the decision and said the Affordable Care Act is here to stay. This was the second time in 3 years that the Supreme Court voted in favor of preserving the Affordable Care Act. So now that the ACA is the law of the land, we'll look at its effects so far. Is healthcare more affordable for the 10 million people who've signed up? Where is it heading from here? And what are the prospects for comprehensive national healthcare, similar to systems in Canada or countries across Europe? In this month's Harper's Magazine, Trudy Lieberman wrote the cover story. It's called Wrong Prescription, The Failed Promise of the Affordable Care Act. She writes, quote, "It's bad enough that the ACA is fattening up the healthcare industry and hollowing out coverage for the middle class. Even worse, the law transfers the growing price of medical care to patients themselves through high deductibles, co-insurance co-payments, and limited provider networks. The biggest winners are the insurance companies, especially those that grew and consolidated over the past few decades. The law has handed them millions of new customers. Competition is unlikely to drive down costs. Five big insurers now dominate the market, making it extremely difficult for newcomers to gain a toehold." End quote. Trudy Lieberman is a contributing editor for the Columbia Journalism Review, where she covers healthcare, and she's author of the book Slanting the Story, The Forces That Shape the News, and she joins us from New York. Hi, Trudy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks.
It's great to have you, and wow, what a great piece. I hope you can all read it. It's about 8 or 9 pages. It's full of so much good information that we don't often get in the day-to-day coverage of the ACA. Let's start off by talking about the Supreme Court decision, because it's making so many headlines, and the Obama administration and his supporters are really cheering this. So Chief Justice John Roberts wrote the court's majority opinion, joined by Justices Kennedy, Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. And in a nutshell, it keeps the ACA as it is. What is your reading on this ruling that preserves subsidies for about 6 million people?
Well, I think the law would have probably fallen apart had the ruling gone the other way from the court. At issue here was the subsidies that are given to about 6.4 million people. I think we have to remember that Obamacare is nothing like national health insurance that we have in other countries, or our own Social Security, or even our Medicare program. This is basically a private arrangement. And as I argue in the piece, it's a means-tested welfare program, very similar to Medicaid and food stamps and many other similar programs, where people qualify for a subsidy to buy insurance if they qualify income-wise, and that means that they have to have income that fits within certain guidelines. So that's very, very similar to other similar kinds of programs that we have in this country. So there were about 6.4 million people who received subsidies last year. About 87% of the people who signed up on the exchanges needed a subsidy because they couldn't afford to buy the insurance on their own. And the average subsidy was about $260-some. So people really did need this if they were going to come under the insurance tent, which was partly the objective of Obamacare here. And so without those subsidies, and had the Supreme Court ruled the other way, they would have been out of luck.
And so, again, 6.4 million people. And this has been very controversial because so many states have opted out of setting up their own exchange systems, like the one in California. 16 states and the District of Columbia have set up their own health insurance marketplaces. 34 states that rely on exchanges run by the federal government have not. Talk about how people in those states have been affected by this.
Well, if the Supreme Court decision had gone the other way, the people in the state exchanges would have been okay. The people in the federal exchanges would not have been okay. But I should add here that from my reporting for the Columbia Journalism Review, many of the state exchanges are having some troubles, and it's a question whether many of them will be sustainable financially as we go forward. And ironically, it's been the federal exchanges that have worked better overall. Mm-hmm. So I think it would have been kind of a perverse result had the court ruled otherwise.
So this is really good news for those 6.4 million people.
Well, they do get to help buying insurance, yes.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about them for a minute, because you've got people who get the subsidies, and then you have people who go onto the website and have to choose between these different plans, which is still very confusing, and we'll talk about that throughout the show. But how are these people doing, the people that get the subsidies, just in terms of their deductibles? Are they going to the doctor when they need to go? Because you interviewed so many people who say, yeah, I've got this insurance, but the costs are still so high that I'm not going unless it's an emergency.
I think there are people in both groups here. I think the insurance has given people a ticket to buy medical care, and it has been of some help. I think that we definitely have seen that. On the other hand, we do see people sort of, as we put it, saving up their pennies to pay for various procedures that they need, because they're now subject to very, very high cost sharing on these policies. And some of these policies can have cost sharing $6,000, $8,000, $9,000, depending on the company and the policy. And I think it's fair to think about what those amounts can actually go up to. I mean, even though the government sets the parameters, they're still quite high on a family policy. That can be upwards of $13,000. And upwards of six or so on the individual policies. So I do think that people are being hurt by this. And I think that it's also important to understand that what family budgets really look like here, and I think this has often been left out of the whole discussion of the ACA, and that's what can people really afford. Mm-hmm. Had people been able to afford insurance before the law was passed, probably would not have needed to pass the insurance law with subsidies, right? But people couldn't afford insurance. And I think that we don't know going forward whether people are still going to be in that bind or not, because so much of the cost of medical care has now been shifted to the individual. And this has been going on, as I trace in the Harper's piece, really for a very long time. The original ideas for this came out of conservative think tanks in the 1990s. They slowly worked their way into the mainstream, and the conservative movement worked very hard through a lot of studies and speeches and all kinds of things like that to make sure that this idea would eventually take hold. And I think what Obamacare did was really sort of cement that idea of high deductible insurance only for catastrophic needs into the American insurance arrangements. So in a sense, we've gone from a situation where people who had coverage in the old days were the old major medical programs that Blue Cross had in the early days that we all knew and grew up with, where Blue Cross paid about 80% of all the bills and we paid 20%, but that 20% was pretty cheap in those days. It really didn't amount to very much. But as costs began to rise without any kind of cost control, that changed and changed rather quickly. So this idea of cost control, shoving the cost to the individual or to the patient, to sick people because they're the ones who have to pay it, has gradually taken hold, and I think Obamacare is going to accelerate that.
Hmm. You point out that about 15 years ago, families paid minimal deductibles of $150 or $200, copays of $5 to $10, or none at all. Today, a family lucky enough to afford a policy may face out-of-pocket expenses for coinsurance deductibles and copays as high as $13,200 before its insurer kicks in. And then you also write that in the post-ACA era, you can be insured but have little or no coverage for what you actually need.
That's correct. It's possible that you go to an out-of-network provider. In New York State, for example, there are no out-of-network benefits, and so you pay the bill. In other states, that's different. You may have some out-of-network benefits, but they may be pretty minimal. And so what happens if you end up in a situation where you've had to use an out-of-network provider, and it's not always possible for us to know that, particularly if you're treated in an emergency room or you have emergency surgery, the anesthesiologist, the assistant surgeon, or whoever is on that team may be out-of-network. They may be a contract doctor with the hospital. The hospital may be in the network, but those contract doctors are not. And so it's not uncommon for people to get snagged into that kind of a situation and find, yeah, well, I do have a policy, but it's not going to cover me. And I think that some people, when this was going through the Congress, didn't really think about all those contingencies, and certainly this idea of narrow networks, although it was around during the heyday of managed care in the 1990s, it kind of fell out of favor for a while, but it has come back because it's a cost control method for the insurance companies.
You also write that the insurance-based healthcare system goes back to 30 years ago, and the idea was to really transform healthcare into a market-driven system. And this was really the fulfillment of a conservative vision. And basically, the idea was to turn patients into shoppers who would look for the best deal on healthcare while shifting much of the cost onto those very shoppers. Can you talk about how these ideas came to play? You say that in large part, the scheme was the brainchild of probably, most people have never heard of this person. I haven't, and we've been covering this for years. J. Patrick Rooney, whose Indianapolis-based Golden Rule Insurance Company specialized in selling policies to only the healthiest customers.
That's right. In the mid-90s, Pat Rooney decided that he thought this was the way to help his company and also help his ideology, which was to convert American health insurance arrangements into something different from what we had at that time. And that was that major medical coverage that I talked about, where people who had insurance had really pretty good insurance and didn't have too many problems with it. So what happened in the 90s was that Rooney used a lot of his own money to promote his idea for medical savings accounts, which is what they were called in those days. And they were regarded by others as kind of a screwball, wacky idea that never had any chance to go anywhere. But gradually, because the people who wanted these kept pushing and kept pushing, finally got Congress to agree to a pilot program that gave these arrangements sort of the nose under the camel's tent. And then by the time we had the prescription drug law passed that gave seniors the right to a drug benefit, they became health savings accounts. They had their name changed during this time. By the time that law was passed, these were pretty much authorized across the country. And then since 2003, we've seen them gradually, although they're growing now, become much more mainstream.
Why do you think the Obama administration embraced this really conservative idea? You quote him many times in your article, and you say that he said, quote, "We thought if we shaped a bill that wasn't that different from bills that had previously been introduced by Republicans, including a Republican governor in Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, that we would be able to find some common ground there, and we just couldn't."
I'm not clear in my own mind whether the president ever supported a true national health insurance plan. I know that a lot of liberal organizations and people who consider themselves progressives believe that he did. And at one point during his campaign in 2008, he said, well, I guess if we were starting from scratch, this might be the way to go, but we're not starting from scratch. To me, it was always clear from the very beginning that he really was not a big fan of that particular arrangement. And I think it's fair to remember that Bill Clinton wasn't either, and Bill Clinton in 1993-94 embraced something called managed competition, which is not too far from what we sort of have now, but with a lot of differences. And so I think that from the very beginning, the idea was to come up with this different way of looking at health insurance, a very incremental approach that would bring more people coverage but would never get us to universal health insurance. And I don't think anybody ever thought that was going to happen, except it was marketed that way, and I think that the public was actually fooled into thinking we were going to have insurance for everyone. In fact, that was the slogan, affordable health care for all, and it was used over and over and over again, and it's still being used even after the Supreme Court decision last week. I saw some people using it, and the media was quoting them. So I guess people are still under this notion that that's going to happen. But even at the time the law was passed, there were 52 million people about who were uninsured, and the Congressional Budget Office, a very good authority on these matters, said that there would be about 30 million people uninsured even after the law took effect. And I think now that has moved up a little bit to about 35 million. So there still is a substantial amount of Americans who do not or will not have insurance or be helped by this law.
Trudy Lieberman is a contributing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. She has a cover story on this month's Harper's called Wrong Prescription, The Failed Promise of the Affordable Care Act. And we'd love to hear from you about how the ACA has affected your coverage. We've done so many shows opening the lines to take your questions about the law because so many people have been confused and probably still are. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. How has the ACA affected your health care coverage? What are your thoughts on the Supreme Court ruling? And then what do you think about what Trudy just said, that this has been spun as affordable health care for all? She quotes Nancy Pelosi, who was talking on Meet the Press in the fall of 2013. She said, this will give people more affordability, more accessibility, better quality care, prevention, wellness. I mean, we heard this over and over and over from the Democrats. And then she also writes that on the left, people like Paul Krugman in the New York Times were constantly praising the ACA, and he definitely praised the Supreme Court ruling on Thursday. So what are your thoughts on how this has been sold to the American people? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from D.C. in San Francisco. Hi, D.C. Welcome to the show.
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. I was one of the 10 people that was invited by the White House to talk to the president about how the Affordable Care Act has affected my life.
When was that?
That was February 4th, 20 of this year.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was unfortunately the same day as the nation found out about the burning of the Jordanian pilot. So I don't think it made that much news. But anyways, I was the only one from California, and I'll summarize as best as I can. Most of the people in that room, if it wasn't for the Affordable Care Act, would literally be dead. There was a woman who sat next to me who, through the Affordable Care Act, found out cancer. There was, I think, two or three people to the left of me who found out one had breast cancer, the other one had prostate cancer. There were two independent business owners saying that the Affordable Care Act really helped their business out and helped their and they encouraged their employees to take the Affordable Care Act. In my case, it was a lot easier for me to get my
D.C.?
That I got better health care.
We just lost you. Can you say that again? The ACA made it easier for you to...
Yeah, the ACA was easier for me to get medication, better health care, and I it's just been a wonderful godsend. I mean, it saved a lot of people money and time in those rooms, in the room that I was in when I was at the White House with the president. I can't speak for him, but I think I can say that we did talk about some of the downsides of the ACA and some of the things that your guest mentioned is absolutely true. He is very much aware that it is not a perfect system. I will even add that he had to work with the Republicans, and I know a lot of the progressives would like to have it like the health care the way they want it to be, but unfortunately you still have to work with the Republicans, and I think that was one of the – I think that's what he was trying to do. I think he was trying to make a win-win situation for both.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. So there's a couple different issues there. Trudy, first off, a lot of people have been saved by the ACA.
That is certainly true. The caller is absolutely right. It has helped a lot of people get care. There is no doubt about that. The argument is, why do we still have a cutoff for those that can't be helped for it? And it's all the people who didn't get Medicaid expanded in their states. It's people we still don't have under the tent. And that's That's the question.
And the Medicaid expansion, a lot of people didn't get that because the governors in their states are not, basically don't want the subsidies, right?
Yes, it's mostly Republican governors right. in southern and Midwestern states that are very much against this. And their agenda, apparently, is that they want to block grant Medicaid ultimately and believe that when they get a Republican in the White House, they might be able to do that, which, of course, means there will be fewer federal dollars flowing into the states for the Medicaid program. And many people believe that would really be catastrophic for the Medicaid program because the Medicaid benefit in the states is really quite a good benefit. And people really do need it. And so I think that that may be underlying some of the opposition. And I deal with that in my piece where I talked about Tennessee, which is a state that did not expand Medicaid. And you can compare and contrast somebody who was able to get coverage. And this woman, I tell her story, although now she's having a lot of trouble paying for her pharmaceuticals because she can't afford the coinsurance, the copays that come with that. But she was very well helped by the law. And then another person I interviewed who's just out in the cold because his income doesn't fit the guidelines now. And so that is the issue that needs to be addressed.
So you write that because the governor of Tennessee has refused to accept the subsidies, the very poorest residents of the state are no better off today than they were before the law. This has left as many as 500,000 of the state's poorest residents without insurance, while thousands more who qualified for subsidized coverage are struggling with high cost sharing and coinsurance. Do we know how many people, if it weren't for these mostly Republican governors, how many people would have insurance?
It's between 4 and 5 million people who are not disenfranchised by the lack of Medicaid expansion in the states. And I know that in this last round of state budgets that were going on the spring into the early summer, there was hope that there would be more states expanding Medicaid, but there really weren't that many. I think maybe a couple did. And in those states, they impose some kinds of onerous restrictions on people getting coverage, like income and work rules. I think that was in one of them, or it was going to be in one of them, restrictions that were not covered. They didn't apply to anybody else. So the backstory is that some of them are just waiting until they can get the right person in the White House to change the Medicaid program in general.
And so can we assume that these are some of the poorest people living in the South who don't have insurance because their governors aren't allowing the subsidies?
Yes, it's people who are below 100% of the poverty line are left out of this. And these are the people who cannot take advantage of the expansion under the ACA. These are people who are too poor to buy their own insurance. And in most of these states, they can't avail themselves of the regular Medicaid program because these programs don't allow childless adults to get benefits. So they really have no options except maybe get help from a community clinic, which is probably what they've been doing all along.
Wow. And again, that's 4 to 5 million people living in these southern states where
Southern and Midwest states.
That is Trudy Lieberman. She's contributing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. She's out with a cover story in this month's Harper's. It's called Wrong Prescription, the Failed Promise of the Affordable Care Act. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. To join in today's conversation, the phone number, toll-free, 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. Let us know if you're a first-time caller, if you'd prefer to write rather than call. The email address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC, and following that at noon today, backstory.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about the current tech boom and the explosion of the tech industry. Billion-dollar companies were once considered rare. Today, there are more than 50 billion-dollar companies in Silicon Valley. More are added every other week. The tech explosion is gentrifying cities, raising property values, and changing urban landscapes. So will this latest tech boom lead to another bust, or will it be with us in the coming years? That's tomorrow. And then on Wednesday, we will talk about small businesses that are embracing alternative economic models and, in some cases, helping to combat gentrification. There's going to be a new coffee shop opening in Oakland that will hire people who've traditionally had difficulty breaking into the industry, people of color, the formerly incarcerated, people with disabilities. The shop will also employ a profit-sharing model where 100% of sales go back to the workers. And so there have been a couple other examples of this in the Bay Area, Northern California, profit sharing, no tips, paying workers a living wage. If you've got any examples of companies that you support, please email them to us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can also email us. Today, we are talking about the Affordable Care Act. After the Supreme Court sided with the Obama administration on Thursday by upholding a key provision of the act, President Obama said it is here to stay. It was a 6-3 ruling. The court upheld subsidies for more than 6 million people living in 34 states. As today's guest, Trudy Lieberman, just told us, about 4 to 5 million people, unfortunately, will not get those subsidies. These are some of the poorest people in the South and the Midwest because their Republican governors refuse to accept the subsidies. Trudy Lieberman has a piece in Harper's, this month's Harper's, called Wrong Prescription, the Failed Promise of the Affordable Care Act. And Trudy is a contributing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review, where she covers health care. And if you'd like to call in to talk with us about your experiences with the ACA, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. And now I would like to welcome our next guest to the show. Dr. Paul Song is on the faculty at the Samuel Oshin Cancer Center at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center and a member of Physicians for a National Health Program. They advocate for a single-payer national health program, an organization of 19,000 doctors. Hi, Dr. Song. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's great to have you. So after the Supreme Court decision came out, Physicians for a National Health Program said they welcome the decision, but note that the suffering that many Americans are experiencing today is intolerable, with about 35 million people remaining uninsured. So first off, what's your reaction to the Supreme Court ruling? Because now that basically means that the ACA is the law of the land.
Absolutely. And I would agree a lot with what Ms. Lieberman has already said. I mean, certainly it's not the type of health reform that many of us who really practice medicine on a day-to-day basis and see the toll take would have liked. But certainly it's better than what we had before, which is nothing. And there are patients of mine that I've seen that have benefited from the ACA, certainly those that have had chronic cancer conditions who were nearing their maximum caps, who are now going to be able to keep insurance. But certainly for the issues that Ms. Lieberman raised, as well as some other things that I still see too many of my own patients going bankrupt despite the fact that they have insurance simply because of a medical illness, we just feel that it's a start, but we need to do a lot better.
Where do you see this going, Dr. Song? Because now the ACA is the law of the land. We're going to see major changes in, is it 2018 with the Cadillac tax? And we'll talk about that in a bit. But things are actually going to change as the years go on. And most people really don't know about these changes.
That's correct. And so I think there are several things. 2018, the Cadillac tax that you mentioned, and a lot of my friends who are brothers and sisters in labor are very upset about that because it will certainly penalize their more beneficial plans. But before we even get to 2018, in 2017, there is a federal waiver in the ACA that allows for states, if they can, to opt out and to set up their own innovative healthcare solutions as long as they meet minimum benefits. And that's really what we are focused on at PNHP and other organizations to try to see if we can affect real change on a state-by-state basis in 2017, since we know the federal legislature is very dysfunctional and ideologically opposed.
Are these the nonprofit insurance co-ops that would compete with the big companies?
Not so much that. I think that what you're seeing, like in New York, where the state assembly recently passed a vote to start to implement single payer, although it is still was held up in the state Senate, I think that's where you're going to see states try to echo what was initiated in Vermont, but unfortunately was tabled in Vermont to go forward in 2017.
Why was it tabled in Vermont?
Well, several things. I think that the approach, it was very difficult. I mean, Vermont has a very small population, but there were too many existing federal restrictions. There was ERISA, which prevented the state from moving state-funded employer-sponsored health plans into a state system. There was the control of Medicare or military TRICARE, which could not be transferred to the state, coupled with the exorbitant cost just to begin this for a small state like Vermont, which is actually has less population than the city of Los Angeles, that would have been very difficult.
Trudy, do you think that's what's next here for people who are fighting for health care for all, is that this is going to happen at the state level? We don't really talk about this much anymore, but I remember Governor Schwarzenegger vetoed single-payer bills a couple of times when he was in office. Now that Jerry Brown is in office, politicians in California have not passed a single-payer bill, which is interesting. And he also, I don't think, has gone on the record saying whether he supports single-payer or not.
Well, we had several experiments in the state in the years before the ACA was passed. Tennessee was one of them. Tennessee had a program called TennCare that was working fairly well, at least initially, but there were no cost controls in that. And what happened was that the managed care companies that were charged with running the show sort of let the pharmaceutical industry do whatever it wanted, and the drug costs went out of control. And eventually the governor pulled the plug on that program and really cut off benefits from people and hurt them very much. So we've had a number of state experiments going on over the years, and certainly we had one in Massachusetts that actually was the baby of Obamacare. And I think that in the end it's very difficult, and I think that one thing has to be kept in mind. In Vermont, the industry started fighting that, and I mean the provider industry, the doctors, the hospitals, the insurance companies, the drug companies, the high-tech companies that have a lot of stake now in healthcare. Mm-hmm. All of these groups were fighting it all along, irrespective of whatever the final budget problems were in that state. So I think those players are still going to be issuing the same kinds of pushback that they have forever. And until we get a grip on how we're really going to deal with that question, I think it's going to be very difficult. So my feeling is, and I'd like to go back to the Cadillac tax for a moment, because people don't know that it's coming. And someone I quoted in my piece said that people just have no idea what's going to hit them as soon as that hits. And they are going, millions of people are going to lose very, very good coverage that they have right now. And the industry, the business community, is trying to push back on that. And whether or not they'll succeed is an open question, because one of the reasons for the Cadillac tax is that the revenue it would generate would help pay for the subsidies for the people who were uninsured. So the government would have to come up with another funding source if the Cadillac tax were to be eliminated. So I would see, I hope PNHP can make inroads on this state strategy, but I think it may be very difficult.
And so the Cadillac tax goes into effect in 2018. You report that this provision will result in millions of workers losing their generous policies. You also say that, for example, 135,000 auto workers will find their benefits at risk in their contract negotiations. Can you talk, just give us a synopsis, what is the Cadillac tax exactly?
Okay, the Cadillac tax was a tax imposed on the employer, and the tax, their basis for it is to try to encourage the employer to offer less generous benefits, on the theory that less generous benefits would also help control costs, because the idea is that if you don't have a generous policy that pays for everything, you won't go to the doctor as often, and you may not get all the care when you want it or you think you need it or whatever. And that does happen, and that has been shown in studies by the RAND Corporation and others, that that does happen, and people don't go to the doctor. So the thinking was that without those generous benefits, people will think twice, and maybe the national health care tab could come down. But what happens is that the employers now are subject to a threshold, and that the policies above that threshold will be subject to the tax. So the employers are going to do whatever they can to reduce what they offer so they don't have to pay the tax. And that will come in many forms, and it may come in the form of more policies with narrow networks. It may come in the form of more cost sharing for their workers. It may come in the form of just different kinds of policies. But I think you're going to see that happen. And we are starting to see that happen a little bit now in the employer community. And we may see it happen far more in the offerings that we'll see in the fall.
Trudy Lieberman is a contributing editor with the Columbia Journalism Review, and she has a piece in this month's Harper's about the Affordable Care Act. It is called Wrong Prescription, the Failed Promise of the Affordable Care Act. We're also joined by Dr. Paul Song. He's on the faculty at the Samuel Ocean Cancer Center at Cedars-Sinai Medical Center, and he's a member of Physicians for a National Health Program, an organization of 19,000 doctors who support health care for all, a single-payer national health insurance program. And if you'd like to join us, if you want to share stories about your health care, if you have any questions about the ACA and what changes are to come, what this means now that it's the law of the land, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go next to Mimi in Monterey. Hi, Mimi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. My comment is in reference to low-income people or people that have, you know, had a sudden drop in income and applying for Covered California. One of the things I've noticed, if you have a child, certain counties, or I should say actually many counties from what I heard in California, basically your child, if you're a Medi-Cal, you don't get a pediatrician. You go to a clinic. And so, for instance, in my case, my son, that is if your child is not terminally ill or labeled with some disorder like Asperger's or autism or something like that. So, like in my case where my son is cognitively delayed and speech delayed, he currently has TRICARE, but with his father leaving the military, he'll lose his TRICARE. And then based on my income, he will be put on Medi-Cal, to which he will lose his doctor. And I've gone in and talked to people, you know, doing the Covered California to ask to see if there's any way I can actually get on a plan, because when I go and apply, I'm automatically told that I'm being sent to Medi-Cal. And then when I explain my situation and the fact that, you know, the clinic didn't help him before, they're not going to help him now, he actually needs to stay with this doctor who finally diagnosed him, unlike the other doctors, I'm told, you know, well, you know, just due to the income threshold, this is where you have to go. And, you know, there's nothing that you can do. And I have friends that, you know, have cancer and things like that, that also, you know, are seeing specialists or things like that. And then now they're going to have to go to Medi-Cal and they won't have access to those doctors. And we're trying to find out why that's not being addressed. Even, you know, when you contact Covered California and you tell them your stories and you tell them what's happening, it seems like nothing's being done about it.
Hmm. Well, thank you for sharing that story. Trudy, are you familiar with this?
Maybe Paul could weigh in on it.
Yeah, so I can actually fill you on this.
Okay.
So I had a chance to spend a year working with State Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones, who's a visiting fellow on healthcare policy, and this is one of the things that he was very concerned about. And certainly he actually addressed this and sent a letter off to Covered California saying that if there were people who, based on income, were Medicaid eligible but wanted to purchase and coverage through Covered California, that they should be allowed to, that their salaries should not exclude them from being able to purchase the insurance if they want it. But the other thing that really the caller identifies is that Medi-Cal really is suboptimal in our state. And as more and more Medi-Cal has been turned over to the private insurance industry and managed care, that's further narrowed the networks. And I have some patients who were on straight Medi-Cal who were then really pressured to join a Medi-Cal HMO, and in doing so were no longer able to see me and some other providers. So I think this is a real, real problem and another sort of unforeseen consequence of where we are. With respect to the caller, I would really ask her to reach out to the California State Insurance Department and our Commissioner Dave Jones, who's very sympathetic, particularly in terms of passing legislation to mandate that more insurers cover autism and Asperger's symptoms therapy, and also those who are sort of caught in the window between Medi-Cal and wanting to purchase private insurance.
Are there any other solutions for Mimi and people like her?
You know, I, unfortunately, right now, no. This is, again, what we need to do is put more of a face on the people that are falling through the cracks. I would really encourage her to get in touch with her representative in the state legislature. As you know, we just SB4 was passed to increase Medi-Cal benefits for all kids, including those that are undocumented. But perhaps as part of that, we could get Senator Lara and others to really make autism coverage as part of that package.
Well, thank you for sharing your story, Mimi, and I hope this helps. And good luck with your child. There's so many people who are in the same boat. I also wanted to ask you both about the role that competition plays in all of this, because Trudy interviewed Dave Jones, the state's California's insurance commissioner, who said that only three insurers are selling statewide, and this lack of competition has tremendous implications for price and choice. And what are your thoughts about this, Dr. Song? Because we had an opportunity to vote for a ballot proposition that would have allowed the insurance commissioner to regulate rates. California insurance companies spent $55 million to successfully defeat that proposition. So what does that mean exactly?
So I'm so glad you raised that, because there were a lot of people, including physicians, who were really hired by organizations to spread lies about that initiative. First and foremost, with regard to the narrow networks and the lack of competition, for those that say let the free market really rule in healthcare, we know there's no free market, and now you have a big push to consolidate even further with Cigna. But with regard to California, that is the problem, that there are ways that the insurance industry has gamed the system. They look at where it's lucrative for them to practice and other areas where it's not. And sometimes you'll see areas close to the Oregon border where you have three providers, maybe even less, with very few options for patients. And I think that is something that Covered California has not done a good job to address. With regard to insurance rate regulation, in the state of California in the last 9 years, premiums have gone up over 150% during the same time at which inflation has only gone up 29% and wages have remained stagnant. And so this was really designed because the ACA did not address insurance rate regulation, was to give the insurance rate approval process to the insurance commissioner, where his actuaries, who are really dedicated public servants who are apolitical, could look at the cost structure and the proposals year after year and decide whether or not insurance rate requests were unreasonable. Right now, all the insurance commissioner can do is to look at that, and if they are unreasonable, is to sort of publicly shame them, but that doesn't stop them from raising rates. But as you know, they spent, as you said, $55 million to spread lies.
I spoke with Dave Jones last week for a piece that I was doing for the Columbia Journalism Review, and this is about this consolidation fever that seems to have gripped the country in the last couple of weeks. And it is not clear how it's going to shake out yet, but Anthem, which is a California company, Anthem is very large in California, as most of your listeners know. What that is actually going to mean in terms of competition statewide, and as Jones pointed out to me, there is very, very little competition in many areas of California, the inland counties, some of the coastal counties, and certainly some of the northern counties, and there is not competition now, and there's concern about when there's more consolidation happening, what is really going to happen. I know that in my piece I talked about a person in upstate New York who was an MBA, very smart guy who knows how to understand insurance and ask the right questions, had a hell of a time trying to find insurance for him and his family, partly because he had very few options. There were only three carriers in New York selling in his region in upstate New York, and they were narrowed even further by what was available from those companies. So I think we have to be realistic about how much competition there is right now in many of these very large states like California and New York.
And Trudy, as you stated in your piece, CNN had a headline after the Supreme Court ruling, big winner from Obamacare ruling, healthcare stocks, specifically hospitals were big winners. I was just looking at a graphic of health insurance CEO pay for 2014. You mentioned Anthem. Joseph Swedish made $8 million last year. Aetna's CEO made $15 million last year. United Healthcare, $66 million last year. Stephen Hemsley, he's at the top of the list.
Well, I think the CEOs of healthcare organizations, hospitals, insurance companies, et cetera, do very, very well. And I think that kind of speaks to the issue in many ways. But I don't see any big movement to try to change that, and I'm not sure that a movement would change that anyway. I think what that shows is the great inequities that we have in our country, and it gets played out in healthcare quite dramatically.
Well, let's take a few callers in a row, and then we'll get responses. Let's go to Joe in Oakland. Hi, Joe. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Am I on now?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I've had pretty good health insurance through various employers for the last, I don't know, forever, 30 years or something. And only recently I've noticed, it seems to me, that the co-pays or the co-insurance is the big one, seem to have gotten a lot bigger than they used to be. Is that something that's always been there and I'm just noticing it now, or is it truly happening? I'm in California.
Okay, you're talking about the co-pay?
Well, there's three things. There's co-pay, mm-hmm. there's deductible,
right.
And then this other thing called co-insurance, which I guess is the 80% or the 90% or whatever. I don't understand all the details. But.
Yeah, and you know, we'll get that in just a minute. We're almost out of time, and I just want to take a few more callers. And yes, Trudy does write about the increases in her piece, but we'll address that in a minute. Let's go next to Ruthann and El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann.
Hi there. I wanted to make a quick comment and then ask a question. I wanted to comment yet again. I am a disabled person who has Medicare, and that Medicare, like single payer, should be, does cover people with disabilities as well as senior citizens. But what I wanted to ask was, my impression or my belief was that the Affordable Care Act passed its last challenge on the individual mandate because it's a very corporatist Supreme Court, and the degree that the medical industrial complex, be it device makers, hospitals, physician groups, everyone else in that group would benefit, propelled the court to rule in favor of it. And I am going to ask Trudy, is what does she think? My sense was that don't have a crystal ball, but I thought it was going to pass muster with the second challenge, with the same thing, the same reasoning being that the entities that stand to gain are all the hospital, medical device, you know, the whole gamut of the in the insurance industry.
All right, thanks, Ruthann. Trudy, do you want to take that one?
It seems to me, I'm gathering her question is, did the in medical industrial complex have something to do with the court's decisions in 2012 and the current one a couple days ago? I can't fathom what the court was deciding. I hope they decided it on the legal issues and the merits of the case. But clearly the Supreme Court doesn't exist in a vacuum and is influenced by politics. But I couldn't really say that exactly. But I do want to respond to the caller about the co-insurance, because there has been a change. It's not that he just missed it. And about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the industry started shifting from a co-pay, which is a set dollar amount that you pay for a service, like $15 or $20 or maybe $40 to go to the doctor, to something called co-insurance, which is a percentage of the bill. And obviously a percentage of the bill is going to cost you a lot more money than a $5 co-pay. So that has changed, and it was a deliberate change by employers and the industry as part of this great cost shift that I talk about.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, and I hope you can read more about it in Trudy's piece in Harper's Magazine. And Dr. Song, we just have about a minute left. Where are you planning to take this fight from here? I mean, what... In terms of citizens and using their voices to push for a more comprehensive plan, whether it's single payer, health care for all, you believe it has to happen at the state level at this point?
Well, obviously, I think, as Trudy mentioned, I do think that the state level is very difficult, and it would be easier because of all of the other provisions mentioned to do it on a federal level. But until we get the real political appetite and will, best thing we can do is educate the public about what a healthcare system that does work, which is our Medicare system. This July 30th is the 50th birthday of Medicare, and we plan to have celebrations throughout the state and country where we really tout what Medicare has been able to do. Despite being constantly undermined by Congress, it is more cost-effective, provides better coverage, and has greater patient satisfaction than the private sector, and we really want to show that. I think what will happen over the next few years is more and more people will become dissatisfied for the reasons that you mentioned. We will still have increased medical-related bankruptcies. We'll have still narrow networks and more and more people that will still be uninsured. So what we're trying to do, at least in California, is first try to get our undocumented brothers and sisters coverage of some sort until we can eventually get to a better comprehensive system, and in the meantime, continue to educate as many people about what we're doing. And that's why I think Trudy's article was so important, because it really shined a light on things that are not talked about with regard to the ACA.
Right. And just quickly, Trudy, you write that even if we fix all the problems we mentioned on today's show, we will still be left with the system's fundamental flaw, and that is high costs and our inability to effectively control them.
That's right. We have never been able to get our arms around that beast, and I don't see it happening anytime soon, but I do think eventually when enough people realize that they cannot afford health care anymore, and I don't know when that will be, but it's going to affect everybody, even people on Medicare. And I think that may be the impetus for some real change.
Trudy Lieberman is a contributing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. Check out her Harper's piece this month called Wrong Prescription. Dr. Paul Song is a member of Physicians for a National Health Program. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How long will the current tech boom last? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the explosion of the tech industry. Billion-dollar companies were once considered rare. Today, there are more than 50 billion-dollar companies in Silicon Valley, with more added every other week. The tech explosion is gentrifying cities, raising property values, and changing urban landscapes. So will this latest tech boom lead to another bust? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Nock Nguyen produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Local Public Radio, KALW, San Francisco. Online, kalw.org. Coming up next, World Have Your Say from the BBC. And following that, at noon, it's Backstory. Don't forget, coming up this Friday night, July the 3rd, at 8 o'clock in the evening, it's the annual Capitol Steps holiday presentation. Join the Capitol Steps Friday evening, 8 o'clock. Here on 91.7 FM, KALW San Francisco, a listener-supported community broadcast service, online at kalw.org.
Hello, I'm Dan Damon. Welcome to World Have Your Say. We're spending the hour speaking to people in Tunisia and Greece.
Of course we're worried. I'm not so insensitive as not to be worried. Everyone's worried. But I'm expecting even worse days.
Banks are shut and Greeks can only withdraw a maximum of €60 each. So how does it feel when your country's financial system shuts down? We'll hear how Greeks are coping with their worsening crisis and whether they believe the politicians who are telling them their money is safe. And from Brussels, there's talk of betrayal of Greeks committing suicide and a European family that's breaking apart. We'll answer your questions on the Greek crisis. Also hear fears from Tunisia about the impact of last week's terror attack. Follow us on Twitter at BBC_WYS, WHYS, or on Facebook.